Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome back to the Criminal Connection podcast. My name's Terry Stone, and today we're joined by the most famous hands in the SAS, Mr. Rusty Furman.
Ah, good afternoon. Thank you for the invite.
I'm just admiring your hands there, Rusty. You've got some nice hands there, mate.
Yeah, I've looked after them, mate. Yeah, need them for the job.
You need them for the job.
I need them for the job.
You know, thanks for coming on the show. Like most people, you know, in the world, had an obsession with the Special Forces since I was a child, and obviously wondered all about, you know, what they do, how they operate, all that sort of stuff. So be great to just hear your story, you know, where you grew up and what led you into the Army.
Well, yeah, thanks for the invite, as I say. Nice to be back down London. Changed place.
What do you think of London now?
I hate it. But to go back to Carlisle, where I was born, yeah. All those years ago, yeah, you know, even at an early age, you know, 14 months, I pissed my mother off and she adopted me. So from there, I was left on my own 2 feet, passed around different relatives over the years, go and live there, go there, go there. So, and that's how it all started. And then finally, I was put into the Army at age 15. Junior Leaders Regiment Royal Artillery. Don't even ask me how I got there, but I did.
How did you get there?
I have no idea. Because I was a long-haired Rolling Stones fan, right?
You so, had my wig on from Rise of the Foot Soldiers.
But actually, that's what I did. And I was forced in, marched down to a place called Nuneaton, Bramcote, in Warwickshire, Junior Leaders Regiment. Straight in, they take one look at you, put you in the chair, shoop, gone. Everything, you're now, discipline. One thing I never had as a kid, nobody to look after me, was discipline. I was wild. And when I went in the Army, £50 after my first 3 months would have got me out of the Army. because that's what it was going to cost. Couldn't get the £50. Went back after that, after the Christmas break, and the initial training had been done then, and then I found myself doing what I wanted to do in the first place, be a footballer.
Why?
Because I always wanted to be a footballer, but I was a skinny runt at 5'2", 7 stone. You know, in my school alone, we had 3 England schoolboy footballers.
Wow.
In one school. So that's...
You didn't have sat in the air up
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah.
It must have been.
Yeah.
It must have been.
But there's 3 in my school alone. So the chances of getting in the school team were nil. But when I went into junior leaders, I started playing for them and grew, within 2 years, I grew about 8.5 inches.
Wow.
And put on, you know, with good food, good training. And I was in a tracksuit more than I was in a uniform for the next few years. And finally, I actually ended up representing the British Army at football.
Wow.
Which is as far, as high as you can go in semi-professional football. Because I was then going to, not unbeknown to me, I was going to be in the army for 27 years altogether.
Wow.
Having wanted by myself out at age 15.
So I suppose really the army for you was like your family.
It became my family because there were still some national service guys knocking around when I left junior leaders. They were footballers. Geordie used to play for Stoke City and places like... They took me under their wing a bit. And then, you know, with them, all we did up in Barnard Castle before we moved down to Salisbury was play football. And in my day, that's what it was. You know, you could go and clean everything up in the morning, knock off in the afternoon, some guys would go for a beer, or you could go and play football and stuff.
Right.
And that's how it was. It's not like that nowadays, but in my day, that's how it was.
So I've got a question for you, Rusty. So back in the day, yeah, right, there was national service.
Yeah.
Now there isn't. Do you think if we had the national service, it would actually be a good thing for the UK?
So national service, I think, was brilliant. It brought a lot of people together. And guys who only went in for 2 years, remember, I think it was for 2 years, the guys who went in for 2 years very often stayed a course after that.
Yeah.
People who didn't want to go in the military, like me, they go in at, was it 18 or something, 18 plus, and they decide that it's for them. And because it was for them, they stayed in and made very good soldiers. You need to have, and I would say, a balance where it's going to work. Because, yeah, you know, it's a difficult one. But I don't see anything wrong with national service.
You know, I just think the way the UK is at the moment, it feels like there's a... It feels a little bit lawless in parts. And I'm sort of wondering whether... People always talk about, you know, these people that are brought up on council estates or don't have a good start and they end up sort of falling into crime or misbehaving. And obviously, if you did have that national service, I know the army's not for everybody, but I definitely think it would install some discipline in everybody. Do you know what I mean? So that's my personal view, but...
No, but it did in me. I was a guy with no discipline. But as I went through my military career, I had to have discipline to do the types of work I was doing and not be a loose cannon, if you like. Yeah. So I had to do that. And, of course, the experienced guys around me, I learnt off. I didn't go in thinking I missed SAS, not at all.
Right.
So I went in and went through the system, into the artillery, into the commandos, got my Greenberry, went from there to the SAS and spent 15 years. Mine was progressive. But when I look back at how I got there, hard work, for definite. But I mean, when you look at me at day one, and you look at me when I came out, you would never have thought it was the same person. Even I thought that.
Wow. Because a lot of people, you know, always sort of say, oh, I'd love to be in the SAS or the SBS or Delta Force. And obviously they don't necessarily know the journey. So the journey for you was, obviously, you went in the junior leaders.
Yeah.
And then when you see the commandos, you actually went in the Marines.
From junior leaders, I went into an artillery unit, 49 Field Regiment. From there, you do the Marine course, but people forget that Marines are administered by the Navy. They're not Army. We, 29 Commando, which is Royal Artillery, down based in Plymouth, are administered by the army. So what you do is you do your own beat-up course, as they call it, for a month, right, to get weasel out the people who are not for it. Once you've done that, you then go straight down to Limston and do the Marine course. Only when you've passed the Marine Green Beret course, you're then given the Green Beret. But you've done both. You've done a beat-up of your own, and then you've done the Marine course. Right. Then you get your Green Beret. And only then do you get it. If you fail that, you don't get it.
Right. I actually went on that PRC course in Limpstone. I tried out for the Marines when I was 17. And I didn't like heights. So I went on that fucking Tarzan thing. I was like up there, and I was just like, oh, I can't fucking do this. And I run along, you know when you run along that thing and then you have to punch through the net?
Yeah, yeah.
I grabbed the net and he went, no, you got to go up there. And I couldn't do it again. I was like, I can't fucking do it. Yeah. So I never got in, which I was gutted about. But at the time, I was boxing and I was into fitness.
Yeah.
And I fancied doing something like that. But for you in the army, the army commandos and the navy commandos, it's the same thing, basically.
It's the same thing.
You've got to do the same course, the same selection process.
Yeah.
And then when you come out of there, did you ever sort of think, oh, maybe I'll do the Special Forces, or did they come for you?
No, it's voluntary. You can't, they don't push you on anything.
No, I didn't know if they asked you to do selection, you know, I didn't know if that was...
Yeah, well, but it's still voluntary. You'd still have to say it's a voluntary, you sign it to say I'm volunteering, and then you volunteer, and then you go on one of the two selections a year, either summer or winter selection, and then you start that, and then you've got the next 6 months... input through it, yeah.
And did you pass on the first one, Musty?
Yeah.
And how hard is it for people that, you know, I know people have watched the SAS reality show, but in real life, how hard is that selection process?
Yeah, well, just turn that off. It doesn't bear any resemblance, okay? But it is hard. It's not just physically hard. It's mentally hard because you're being tested, you're being watched. You don't know what times you've got to do certain tests in. They only tell you afterwards. So everything is getting as much out of you that you can put into it in all different ways, you know. And at the end of test week itself, you've got the famous 42-miler when you've been beaten for a whole month. And then you've got the 42-miler on the last day with full weapon, you know, and kit and equipment on your back.
How heavy is the gun and the backpack?
All of it together would have been about 60 or 70 pounds.
Right. So anybody watching this or listening this is at home.
Water, you've got water, which is heavy as well.
If you want to go out for a 3 mile run, try that, and then you'll see how fucking hard 42 miles is.
But I'm not being funny. On the physical side, I was always fit anyway. But I've seen people come and go, and every day they're dropping out. You know, when you get up in the morning, you see another bed empty that night. It's not for everybody. Lots of people have tried.
When you saw the empty bed, were you like, fucking lightweight?
Yeah. Yeah, because he didn't have to buy him a pint that night when you're coming off the training. He was gone. Wow. But it's not for everybody. And, you know, I take my hat off to people who've tried it and failed.
What is the pass rate? Is it about 10%?
I don't know what it is now. I don't keep tabs on anything to do with them anymore. But I think on mine, it was quite a good pass rate because in 1977, when I did it, the parachute brigade were being disbanded. Right. And there was a lot of paras, a bit disgruntled about it all. It was either go that way, I'll have a go at this SAS selection. So ours was probably a 30 or 40% pass rate maybe. But generally, I would think in the day, 10 to 15 to 20 would be a good pass rate. So, they come from all walks of life, as you know, all different units.
I mean, I think, when you look at now and you look at then, I think we were much more sort of harder, resilient. Do you know what I mean? I think now people are a lot less, you know, when you put people through something as extreme as that, that you've got to be, you know, slightly sort of fucking crazy. What a 42 miles.
Jesus.
No, but you have, haven't you, right? And it's not for everybody. And
no, it's not for everybody.
A lot of people would just go, yeah, I want to join. And then when they get maybe into mile 10, they go, fuck this, I'm going on.
But you say that, and it's quite true, because some guys used to come from Germany to do the course. You know, when we had troops in stationed in Germany, they used to come across, and they knew that once they were there, they could have a couple of weeks in the UK. And I've known people come, get the kit, put the kit on. The next day, they take the kit off and hand it in and go and leave for a week or 10 days right. in the UK.
And for holiday.
I've seen it happen more than once. And their whole was coming across, but never having any, nothing to do with selection. They just about fitted their kit and took it off and handed it in and off they went. Now they're in the UK for 10 days, just having a swan, you know. Yeah. But yeah, I've seen all of that.
And what would you say for you personally was the hardest part of the selection process?
I've always said that getting on that vehicle in Hereford in the morning, and driving out to the training area, doing everything on the hills, then driving back after it, that used to piss me off. The actual physical, I swear to God, I loved it. Wow. And I mentioned more than once that drive out from Hereford out to the Brecon Beacons and stuff, just to be dropped off and then picked up later on. I hated that.
Right.
Running around the hills, I enjoyed it.
And when you actually get told you've passed, yeah. what is the ceremony? Is it literally just like you stand all up and, you know, it's like a proper like parade thing and then they physically present you with a beret? Or is it more private thing when they...
Well, I think it's quite rude, I'll be honest.
How's it going, mate?
It's even better than that. When you find out you've passed,
yeah.
They then say, right, you're in B squadron, you're in A squadron. So a lot of the guys have asked which squadron they could go in. So if they can accommodate that, they did, because, you know, four different squadrons, A, B, D, and G. But once you've got it, and they say, right, I want you to go and get to the quartermaster store. Go over there and get your beret and belt and then go over to B Squadron for me. And then introduce yourself to the sergeant major. He'll introduce you to the guys. You go over there and the QM will just pick up a beret and belt. What size are you? 6 7/8. There's your belt. There's your beret. Now get yourself across to your squadron. It's like that. There's no, unlike the Green Beret, right. You know, where you get parade and, you know, if you've got parents, they come up to watch it and clap. And it's not like that. Wow. It's just, it's rude. it's a rude awakening, right. You know, so you don't expect anything special. You don't get anything special.
Yeah.
It's simple as that.
When I was up in Hereford, and I know it might have changed since you was there, but I probably hasn't. What I loved about it was everywhere you go, there's a bar.
Oh, yeah.
And I did actually think, how many bars are in here? And there's something like 21 bars or something on the base. And I actually said...
There's probably,
but drinking is their national pastime, isn't it?
Yeah. But they didn't have that.
Oh, you didn't have all their bars?
No.
Right, okay.
Now, we had a sergeant's mess, officer's mess,
right.
And one other. That was it. The Paladin Club.
Yeah.
That was that.
And when you passed and you went into B Squadron, I mean, for the viewers and listeners, what's the difference between the squadrons? If you can just go through the different four squadrons, just so they know.
Well, there's no difference apart from A, B, D, and G. And G was... going back years ago, was formed from the Guards, that's hence G. A, B, and D are just the you know, there's other squadrons around, like C Squadron, but, you know, but ours are A, B, D, and G. And basically, there's no difference in the standards. They've all got the same four troops within the squadron.
So what are the four troops then? There's obviously the mountain, there's the boat.
Yeah, mountain, boat, mobility... and mountain boat mobility, free fall.
Right.
And they, if you think about it, if required, those four are all methods of infiltration. If you needed to get in somewhere, free fall, boat, mobility. So, you know, so it goes down that route.
Did you have the dogs there when you was in the regiment?
No.
Right, okay.
No, we had dogs, but not the type of dog that they have now.
Yeah. It's quite amazing when you see them with the helmets and they're like flak jackets and the stuff they're trying to do now. I mean, it's a different level. I mean, you know. Yeah. I didn't know if you used the dogs like they use them now.
No, they didn't. They're definitely not. But one asset, and I've seen them being trained and stuff, you know, it'd be great to have them.
You definitely don't want one of them on your back.
Yeah, no. No, Melanoise.
Right.
No.
When you went into B Squadron, what was your first assignment? Was it literally as soon as you got in, or did you have to wait a few weeks before you actually went into
I went in November 77. I didn't have to do the parachute course because I'd already done it when I was in the commandos. Right. So the month when they go off and do parachute training and jumping out of aircraft and things, I'd already done that. So we had the... I remember having the Christmas off and then came back, and my first tour was in Northern Ireland for 6 months.
I bet that was fun.
It's almost fun, but I got my long hair back.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it was right down here.
Because that's the other thing that a lot of people don't know about, obviously, Special Forces. They're not as... You don't have to have your hair... When you're in the regular army, it has to be...
Down to the wood. Yours is long. But seriously, yeah.
And what was Northern Ireland like? Because a lot of people I know said that it was a very dangerous place.
It's a dangerous place, but I enjoyed my time. Got some... I'm never going to speak about the jobs, but had some...
How was the point of coming on the podcast then? I thought you just spilled the beans, Rusty.
No, I spilled the beans to a certain degree, but actually there was lots of different jobs there, right. And you got to know a lot of the police quite well, your special branch, and you know, and you see the bigger picture of what's really going on, what you're told and what you're actually working against is two different things totally.
Because I know that there was that sort of whole peace process and, you know, everything was solved. But I mean, was it really, or do you think it's...
Yeah, always... about the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's not solved. You know, in my opinion, it's not solved at all.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, when you have these various wars and issues around the world, and obviously on the surface, you're told this is what's happening, and then it's all been resolved, or the bad guy's gone now. Here's another nice guy that's going to take over.
Yeah, it's everything about it is what you read in social media, but it's not the real truth. It's what they want
on social media. Was true.
They want you. It's what they want. What you get told is what they want you to believe. And of course, a lot of the people are sheep. They follow.
Right.
You know. So what they're told, they go along with. But actually, there's a bigger picture. And you're never going to get, you never ever get to know the bigger picture, because the guys who are putting it out are formidable liars. And they tell the lies which you want people to believe. A lot of people believe it. And it's only my opinion, by the way.
Yeah.
And people believe it, but they don't want to look around the corner just to have what else is happening. And they don't do that because they want to believe. And certainly going back to the Good Friday Agreement, no, it's not fixed.
Right. It's a shame, really, because I know a lot of people who, you know, on both sides of that. And I remember when there was that bombing as well in Brighton as well.
Maggie Thatcher.
Yeah, I mean, that was...
Yeah.
You know, that was the RO, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was missed by... Fairly close, but when that happened...
Was you a Maggie Thatcher fan?
Yeah.
So I was as well.
Yeah.
She was good.
I'm definitely a Maggie Thatcher, especially when I see the state of what we've got now, with Big Nose Sunak and stuff. I mean, what's wrong with these people? They won't stand up for anybody. They're another bunch of liars. Thatcher, at least, she had her faults, don't get me wrong.
I think what was good about her, though, obviously, I'm working class and I've lived on a council estate, and she gave us the right to buy our council home. So without that going through, we may never have owned house. So I was always grateful for that. And I don't know, there was something about her. I mean, obviously, like you said, she had her faults. But for me, she was sort of like for the people. Yeah, I know it sounds mad, but I did watch Citizen Smith as a kid. Yeah. All that Power to the People stuff. I did think she grabbed a bit of that.
Yeah, but I'll be honest with you. I'm talking about from a military side, being in the military when she was Prime Minister.
Yeah.
You saw how quickly she reacted at the Iranian embassy siege. As soon as they had proof of murder on UK soil, you know, she put the dust...
Get Rusty on the phone. Rusty, don't need any gloves, mate. Go in there and fucking wipe them out.
Yeah. And then the Falklands, she put the task force together. But she didn't really muck about. But right. There are some sides to the story. I've met her a few times.
What was she like, though?
Yeah, she's okay. You know,
did she have that? She had that bag, didn't she? She always had that. It looked like she had a gun in it or something. Oh.
Yeah, right. Well, Margaret Thatcher, yeah, I met her a few times. Yeah. Did a few demonstrations in the camp for her. Right. Dignitaries come to the camp. And after the siege ended, she came to Regent's Park Barracks with her husband, Dennis Thatcher, and William Whitelaw, the Home Secretary. They came and said thanks and went round and spoke to everybody. And, she's very approachable.
Yeah.
No problem. But at the same time, I like the way she handles stuff.
Yeah.
And as I say, I've heard about certain things, but actually I'm talking about how she supported the military, gave them a pay rise, actually.
Yeah.
So it wasn't all bad.
I mean, that was one thing. I know in Hereford there's the Clock Tower charity, and they obviously raise a lot of money for the guys when they obviously die in action. And I thought that was a nice touch. And I do support that charity and help raise money for the regiment. But when I actually found out what the guys get paid, I was shocked because I thought they would have got paid a lot more.
Yeah,
they do risk their lives every time they go on a call. They could die. Yeah. Right? So
yeah, you know, you join because you want to join. You know, the pay would always like to. Everybody would like to have more pay.
Yeah.
But I do know that from when I was serving, that guys enjoyed what they did.
Yeah.
And I can say now that my 15 years there, that nobody had to motivate me, and there wasn't a day that I didn't want to go to work.
Right.
How many people can say that in the jobs that they do? Not many.
Not many, yeah. I mean, I being the pop father.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously. every day's fun for me.
Yeah, I bet.
but I'm not jumping out of planes killing people. So. but for you, when you did the Northern Ireland, you was there for 6 months.
It was 6 month tours. Right. Then you swap over, another squadron comes in.
And was it literally patrolling stuff, or was it more like undercover stuff where you sort of went undercover, and walked around going top of the mind?
Pretty much more undercover, but. Right. I did work with the Green Army, as they call it.
That's the Irish guys? That's their...
No, our guys. But the other military, not the SAS side of it.
Right.
Yeah, we call them the Green Army because they were always in green stuff. We were in all sorts of stuff.
Right.
So if we wanted to refer to them without using name, it'd be the Green Army.
Got it.
It's just something that's been there for years. It's not...
And I know you can't talk about any... actual operations because of the Official Secrets Act, but when you was out there, I mean, was it mainly taking people off the streets and getting rid of them, or was it more about preventing them executing whatever they were doing?
It's a mixture of all of it. Right. You know, we didn't have one specific job. If you were going to do a job, it'd probably come from the special branch, Irish. Right. They'd have whatever information they have, pass it in. Is it a job for us? And it would be all of that.
Right.
So it wouldn't be the same job every day or the same thing every day. It'd be mix and match over the period of time you were there.
And if there was an ammunitions cachet or some guns or some explosives, would you seize that or would it be blowing up?
It depends. if it's there to be picked up, hidden, sometimes you get people who inform, and they will tell, but you never know then if, they call it a come on, you know, let's get them into the area, us, and then have somebody there possibly waiting to do no good, you know, to try and take our guys out.
Would they?
It's called a come on. They want you to come.
But would they be like, like in modern day sort of terrorism, these guys or women will be strapped up with bombs. Would they do that, or would it be more that they'd have a pistol or a sniper?
It would be shootings.
Right.
Shootings mainly. You've heard the story of Warren Point and the Paras and when they all got blown up and stuff. So they were mixing, but we were learning all the time. And that's the secret. If you can stay a step ahead, that's the secret, and that's why we were successful.
When I'm saying that, I mean the RA, the way that they would have their sort of command, they'd have like an operations in how they would work.
Yeah.
And then you basically then work out how they're doing their thing.
Yeah.
And I take it like when you have a structure. Once you've worked out what it is, then it's easier to catch them because they're...
Well, that's the secret, isn't it? Because, you know, if you can arrest them, it's taking them off the street, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the aim of it, to get them off the street, whichever way you can.
Was there a lot of arrests or was it? Did it mainly go beyond that? You just had to literally take them out?
Well, that's part of the deal, isn't it? You know.
I doubt they'd all go...
Nah.
Sorry, officer.
They were quite well armed.
Right.
You know, so let's not take that away from them.
Yeah.
But I still think, I still actually believe that, you know, when it eventually came to an end, it's never gone away. It might be hidden and it might be used as a cover for something else now.
Right.
But it's not gone away and it hasn't fixed anything.
Wow.
It's gone quiet.
So it really was just a publicity stunt, that whole thing?
I think so.
Wow.
A pat on the back for some, you know. But, yeah, you've got to have been on the ground there to understand how difficult it was to work.
Wow.
Especially with an English accent.
So you didn't go full Irish then?
No.
A lot of the guys in the Special Forces do that. They actually do... wear disguises, they do put on accents, they do learn languages. So
languages and stuff, yeah. But that, I was talking specifically about Northern Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Mickey Finn and...
Right.
But no.
Did you lose any regiment guys when you was over there? Or?
Yeah, there's a couple.
Right.
Yeah.
And but I take it, it was... there was more of them went than you, so it sort of all balanced up.
Oh, I hope so.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
And then when you come back from Northern Ireland, what was your next...
Jungles in Belize.
I mean, what was that like? Because it doesn't sound like
it's
much
a,
fun.
It's a filthy jungle. Belize in particular, it's very thick. And it's not clean. You know, like the jungles of Brunei, let's say.
Right.
And other jungles are clean. You know, but Belize itself was pretty, it's the roughest jungle I've been in.
Wow.
And I've been in quite a few.
Is that because the spiders have got baseball bats and the snakes have got hammers?
Yeah. But yeah, it's very difficult to work in. You know?
Someone said, I've never been to a jungle, but someone said it's really hard to breathe, feel very close.
Well, it is, because you're wet all the time.
Yeah.
If you're not sweating, which you always sweat, and so you've got your wet kit on all the time. And
you'd have thought if they were that hot, they'd all wear mankinis, wouldn't you?
Or camouflage.
Camouflage mankinis.
Yeah.
As long as they've got... Is it an SA-80? Is that the gun they have?
We never use them. The Green Army have got SA-80s. We used to use Armalites and AR-16s and things like that, yeah. It's a weapon of choice, but I'm afraid the SA-80 is at the bottom of the list.
Right, okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
The weapons of choice was the Armalite AR-15. And then
when
else?
I was there, AR-16, AR-15, M203, which is the one that fires a bomb underneath,
yeah,
for those who know what it is.
Anyone who plays Call of Duty,
grenade! That's it. That's it, yeah. But they're real ones.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
blow people up.
Yeah. So pretty much they are, let's go back to Vietnam, not that I was there, but they used to use them, and they're very, very tried and tested weapon, the AR-15, 16, M203. So if it was good enough for them, it's certainly good enough for us.
But an AR-15, 16, is that...
Armalite.
It's a long rifle, or is it...
It's lighter than the SLR.
Right.
Which was the British Army standard prior to the SA-80.
Right.
So it's a nice weapon, easy to clean, easy to use, very robust, and it's ideal for places like that.
And what was the pistol you'd be issued with? Was that?
Well, mine was a 9mm high power Browning,
right?
Which was bog standard issue in those days.
Did you have a choice, or was it literally that?
There was some other ones, but I always. All I did was put some different grips on, you know, Pachymeyer grips, they're called. And they were a bit more to get your hand onto.
Right.
Apart from that, it was a bog standard, and it may have had a high-profile sight towards the end,
yeah,
front sight and rear sight.
And the jungle warfare, or the training, or whatever you want to call it, was that just to get you ready so that if there was ever a call out when you had to go, something like that, then...
Well, that's what we did, didn't we? Belize was under threat from Guatemala.
I didn't know that.
Right. Yeah, in the 70s. I did my jungle training there when I was on selection. The next time I went out, I was in my squadron. But that was... that. There was a threat from Twatoguat.
Is that what they were called? That was the
technical name. That was a T-shirt, Twatoguat. But... the Guatemalans, yeah, because it borders Belize, and they were bumping their gums about this, that, and the other, but it never got really off the ground.
Right.
I think there's some skirmishes, but that was it.
Did you ever go anywhere really cold?
South Atlantic.
Wow. So you've gone from the jungle to the South Atlantic.
But that was in the Falklands. I went there.
Oh, she was in the Falklands?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but guess what? When we went to the Falklands, it was so quick. We went there with jungle attire. It was all jungle kit. It wasn't any warm weather kit, nothing. Right. And we jumped into the South Atlantic.
It was fucking free.
It was, yeah. that ain't a joke, mate. I mean, I had to piss inside my wetsuit to get it warm. What? Seriously. And then you just bob along. Until somebody comes and picks you up.
Wow.
But underneath my wetsuit, the time I was there, I had jungle warfare kit on.
Oh, so you actually wore the wetsuit and the jungle thing at the same time?
That was to jump into the Atlantic from the C-130s. That's how we got into the.
Well.
That's wow. How we got to the fleet. We flew, refueled a couple of times in midair, and when we got into the, when we could see the fleet, it was time to jump out into the Atlantic in a snowstorm. You could see a boat, you couldn't see it. And once we hit the water, you just waited.
I suppose that's probably a scary time because you're absolutely freezing.
Freezing.
You're just hoping that somebody doesn't fucking forget you there.
But if you read, when you read my book, one of them, you'll see that the first thing I saw, because you've got a life jacket on your back, and you can see like this. That's about it. And the first thing I saw was a knife. And it came down straight through my life jacket, and they pull you on board.
Wow.
The inflatables. And that was the first thing I saw.
You saw a knife because you're thinking, please don't be Argentinian, please don't be Argentinian.
But
you can have the fucking island.
Yeah. You can have that. And the oil. Take the oil with it and the minerals, yeah. But that's the first thing I saw was a knife. It cut the life jacket. Because I'm still, at that stage, I had my parachute on. Yeah. But that was it, you know.
When you was in the Falklands, I mean, obviously, comparing it to like the Northern Ireland thing, it was a fairly short war, wasn't it?
Yeah, April to June.
Because I remember Maggie basically sending the boats, and I remember like, yeah, we're gonna have a war now.
It was early April. I can't remember the exact date. 6 maybe springs to mind, but it finished on the 14th of June.
Wow.
So it was a short conflict. I don't even call it a war. Am I right? Am I wrong? I don't know.
But did you get to do much there, or was it mainly just...
No. What we did is our job. The other squadrons were already there. I was on a language course, actually, when I got taken off and said we're going down to the Falklands. Okay. So our job was... to go to Ascension Island first, halfway. And there we were going to train for a specific operation, which was against mainland Argentina. And that's what we did. So we practiced all this C-130, landing and taking off and jumping out and attacking. Because unbeknown to a lot of people, there was 3 Exocet missiles left in that base, Punta Gorda. There was 3 Exocet missiles which had done all the damage to the guards. Remember when their boats got blown up and a lot of injuries?
Well, I remember.
They were caused by Exocet missiles. Right. Exocet missiles were given to Argentina by the French,
yeah,
our mates.
Cheers. Cheers, Macron.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, big nose. And our job was to stop those Exocet missiles being used. So we kept practicing to hit the Argentinian airbase, find those Exocet missiles, destroy them, destroy the aircraft that flew them, the Super Etendards,
right,
and kill the pilots. And then escape and evade, if anybody was left, over the mountains into Chile. Because Chile was a little bit friendly, because Maggie Thatcher was quite pally with Pinochet.
Right.
So we had a safe, but it was nicknamed, for obvious reasons, Operation Certain Death, because 2 C-130s to land in the middle of Argentina with no air support, no nothing. And what, 60 guys, 70 at the most, and then take out all of them and then escape and evade. When it was surrounded, the airbase was surrounded with Marines, I think you'll agree that not only would it have been hairy,
yeah,
the chances of me sitting here today would have been like nil. But that was called off at the last minute. As you probably remember, we had 19 guys die in one helicopter incident.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right. Those guys were from 2 different squadrons, not our squadron. And there had to be a reshuffle of men, equipment and so on, because they died instantly when that chopper went into the South Atlantic and plunged to the bottom.
What caused that? Was it a mechanical fault, or was it...
There's a number of... They said a bird strike, you know, the big albatross through the engine intake, overloading the helicopter, yeah, because the guys were cross-decking, going from one to another boat. They all got on there, then it went bang. Of course, they all went to the bottom that quick.
Wow.
And that was 19 of them in one go.
That's a lot of guys, isn't it?
Yeah. And so... Our plan was taken off, and we were dispatched to take over. One squadron was coming out as we were going in, but the war finished a few days, you know, not long after.
Yeah.
But suffice to say that it was a big shock, and what a waste of lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's funny, a lot of people hear about special forces, and they just think they just, you know, come into war. But I mean, like with the IRA, which is, you know, a terror criminal, whatever you want to call it, organization, obviously they were deployed against them. When we actually look at home soil, how after the Argentinian war with the Falklands, I'm just trying to think of the timeline. The actual Iranian embassy siege, that was that 82?
That was, no, the Falklands was 82 and the siege was 80.
Got it. So the siege was actually before the Falklands war, right? So, yeah. So
the 30th of April, 5th of May, 1980.
Wow. So that, so again, that was an, I don't know if you call them criminal or terrorist organisation, you know, doing what they did. It's when the Iranians, they broke into the embassy, didn't they? And they,
No. It was the Iranian embassy,
right,
in Princess Gate, number 16 Princess Gate.
Yeah.
And it was the six heavily armed terrorists who were Saddam Hussein back from Iraq.
Right. The terrorists. So it was the Iraqis that held up the Iranian embassy.
That's right.
Got it. I'm trying to remember it. It was so long ago.
Yeah.
I was only 9 then.
You're only 10 now.
Right. How old was you then, Rusty? When that?
30.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what happened? I mean, you was obviously up in Hereford.
Yeah.
You got the call.
It's all in my book here.
Let's have a look. Let's have a look at your book. Because, you got two books. I love that.
Yeah. That's,
so you've got one about the regiment.
That's my career up until I left the regiment.
Amazing.
This one, Go, 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 is a definitive story of the Iran embassy siege, which is turned into a film, 6 days.
Do you know something?
Have you seen it?
I saw it, and I wanted to ask you, Rusty, what's it like being played by Billy Elliot?
Or ballet dancer. Let me tell you a story then. Right? I went out to New Zealand to meet the stuntmen, the actors, and Jamie Bell.
Right.
So I gave him a book and said, you've got to become me. There's my book. He read my book while we're there. However, Jamie Bell here, right, he and the stuntmen and actors took off to one side to teach them shooting techniques, which you've seen in 6 days of film. I took them off to one side, but I was concentrating on all of them, but I'd take Jamie to one side because he had to become me, hence the no gloves and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So Jamie, a ballet dancer, me trying to teach him how your feet should be.
Has he been very graceful? Shooting.
Yeah.
Shooting people.
Yeah, a bit fancy. Right. So your feet.
But what a great thing, though, to be able to say, Jamie Bell, a.k.a. Billy Elliot, played me in a movie. I mean, that's a cool thing.
But the thing is that when his feet, because he was a ballet dancer and a dancer, or whatever you want to.
I thought he was playing a role. He's actually a ballet dancer.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
Right. Well,
sorry, Billy and Jamie.
But anyway, let's say he was a dancer, right? But he did all them whizzy things.
Pillowcats when he was killing people.
So I was getting him to say, right, this is how you do it, Jamie. You've got all the kit on, right? He's got all the kit on, all the black kit, weapons, MP5. I'm saying to him, I'm going to play you. So I video him, play it back, and say, Jamie, useless. So he beat himself up, right? Go back and do it again. So he'd go and do it again. And eventually I got pissed off with him. And I said, Jamie, look, he said, Rusty, I'm a dancer, you know. I said to him, just remember, Jamie, Rusty don't fucking dance. And he got it. He got it on the spur of the moment. He got it.
Right.
And that's from then on in.
It was, in
Hereford. Yeah, yeah. No tap dancing here, mate. But that's what I said to him.
Right.
But it was good fun training him and having some fun with him, yeah. But it was done in.
How long did it take him to actually fully get it? So you watched him and went, kid's got it now.
2 weeks.
Wow.
2 weeks.
So ballet dancer to SAS hero in 2 weeks. If you want to book Rusty, he's available.
Yeah.
he can help you release your inner SAS.
Bring your own ballet shoes as well. Man of four. But yeah, so that was the fun part.
Amazing.
But they read my book, Go, Go, Go. The New Zealand Film Corporation came to UK. I introduced them to some of the guys, let them tell their story, what happened there. Amazing. They knew my story because it was in the book.
Yeah.
And they decided to pick something which was the camaraderie part, like some of myself, John McAleese. I had no gloves, so I was an easy target. And that's how they put that film together from the book.
Wow. Now, we should actually talk about, obviously, you became the most famous hands in the SAS. So we should actually talk about the story. So, you know, when you got the call up, what happened? Where was your gloves, Rusty?
I didn't call myself the most famous hands in SAS history.
No, but I love it. Caught, I love that somebody's done it.
But they were caught by the police sniper on the day, May the 5th, when we went in to do the resolution. So my gloves, to answer your question, were left on the table from the time when we were sat watching the snooker. Basically, Cliff Thorburn was playing Alex Higgins in the final of the Embassy World Championship. And right in the middle of that, we got the call, because it produced a dead body then. They'd killed Lavasani, the young press attaché from the Iran, and they dumped him outside. That was right in the middle of the snooker. But his body was
a policewoman killed as well.
Sorry?
Was a policewoman killed, or was that a separate incident?
No, that was the that was another embassy.
Yeah, because
I'll come on to that one in a minute.
So many embassies, Rusty.
But proof of murder, that was proof of murder, and we were ready. So we got the call. Mrs. Thatcher, at the time, handed control. It was a police operation, for those who don't remember, supported by the SAS. As soon as that proof of murder was on there, the Prime Minister ordered the SAS to take over from the police, and the police then supported us, really, because we had to go in and rescue the hostages. And that was the mission, to rescue the hostages. Nothing else, rescue the hostages. I left my gloves on the table where the snooker was on the TV. Normally, I'd put them down my body armour.
Right.
I hadn't this time. I'd put them on the table when I went out with my team. Go outside, but realised I didn't have my gloves. But I wasn't going back for them because we were getting into position to go and rescue the hostages. So really, my gloves I picked up when I came back. But in the meantime, the police sniper who took the picture, the famous picture of me with no gloves on and my team around me, that became the most famous hands because of exactly what I've just told you. I was the only guy without them, and I was a team leader.
You was actually leading that whole thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
I took over from Roy on the final assault, yeah.
And for people listening or watching this, obviously you can go on Google, YouTube, there's videos, there's footage, there was obviously a lot of news footage, images. But when you're actually there, Rusty, talk us through what it's actually like to do a, you know, fucking siege an embassy. I mean, it sounds cool, right? But I mean, the actual thing that you do, I mean, the adrenaline must be pumping. You must be literally just locked in, you know, ready to fucking switch some people off.
Well, it's a fact. I mean, you know, we've been there for 6 days, hence the name of the film, 6 days on Netflix. And we trained and rehearsed and planned every minute we were there, we were using as if we were going to go into that embassy and rescue the hostages. No sitting back waiting, or maybe we had three different plans at one stage, what we were going to do. So we don't have one plan, we had three.
So just so we can all understand this, you have three plans. Is that because...
We could have had four. We could have had five.
Is it literally then at the time you go, which is the best one? Or do you execute one? If that doesn't work, then you go to the second plan.
Yeah, but because we had the time, nobody knew how long the operation was going to go on for. So we had one plan, which was the initial plan, which gets updated over the years. Over the hours and days you're there. Nobody knows how long that's going to be, but you've got a plan. If you've got time, you have other plans, and we call it what if. What if something goes wrong? What if you've got something else? You don't get caught short. And the third plan was another one, what we were going to do, all different types, based on the first plan, which was our favourite. But it never quite worked out like that, because as we'd planned, prepared, rehearsed, in case we were going to be used, you don't know what's around the corner. you know, it came in the middle of the snooker. The body was produced. We had our plan. We knew what it was going to be. So the plan one that we had, first of all, was the plan we were going to, you know, hit the building to simultaneously 56 rooms on 11 floors. I beg your pardon, 56 rooms on 6 floors.
It's a big space, right?
It's a big space. And to do it simultaneously, we already had the plans, who was going through which windows or doors.
So how many guys were there in your team?
Guys that went into the building, 32.
That's a lot, isn't it? Wow. Because when you saw it, it looked like there was about 8 of you.
There was about 70, just on about 70 on the operation from the squadron command, hedgehead as we call it. Actually, guys who entered the building, two teams, red and blue team, there was about 32 guys. The rest were reserves, hostage reception, that type of thing out the back. About 32 guys from the top to the bottom and front and back simultaneously. In case one gets held up, you're hoping another team is going to get through, because every plan you put together, it doesn't matter what you do, don't ever expect it to work as it's being believed to work. There's going to be, and there was, we had a few problems, but the guys that I worked with are all experienced, and they've all got two things that I always mention. Adaptability and flexibility.
Can you repeat that again, Marcy? Sorry, I coughed over you then, sorry.
Yeah. It's okay. What did I say?
You said there's two things.
Yeah, there's two things, two qualities, let's say, that the guys have got. And it's called adaptability and flexibility. You've got a plan. It's going okay. What happens? What if something goes wrong? You've got to get round that obstacle to achieve what? To achieve your mission. And the mission was to rescue the hostages, of which at that stage there was 19 left in the building.
Wow.
25 to start with, but was 19 still in there when we assaulted the building to rescue the hostages for the resolution, let's say.
And there were six terrorists?
Six armed terrorists,
wow.
Yeah.
And what did they have? Was it just like guns, or did they have explosives as well?
Hand grenades and guns.
Wow.
But we didn't know if there's any booby traps in there at all.
Did you have a way of looking into the building, like thermal imagery, so you could actually see where
they
were?
No, we didn't have thermal imagery, but they had devices, which the spooks, you know, the spooks, they were putting in devices, listening devices mainly, to try and find out where they were in the building. It's quite accurate, considering it was 43 years ago, nearly now.
Wow.
So it was
quite... At least you kind of knew where... they'd be around.
We knew roughly where they were, second floor. Right. But actually, it was the second floor, first floor, and ended up on the ground floor. The top floors, there was no action up there at all. But you couldn't... You still had to assault that to pronounce it clear. That's where our plan was. So once the whole building was clear and the terrorists had been dealt with and the hostages were rescued, then it was a matter of getting everybody out of the building to the back, where they could all be accounted for, handcuffed for those who needed it, females, males, any surviving terrorists. So you'd have all this out the back with the teams of guys that their job was to make sure that happened. And then when that was happening, then the place was ablaze all over, you know. And during the assault, you could hear them screaming and shouting, people falling down the stairs and as they were being pushed one-to-one.
And when you go into a siege, I take it you don't know who is hostile and who isn't. So I take it you just round them all up and cuff them all up.
Out the back, the ones that were engaged inside the building were terrorists, because we'd been studying faces.
Right.
Eventually, they found passports... they were left in their bedsit in, I think it was Earl's Court.
Wow.
And they took photos. So each A4 size piece of paper had a mugshot on it. And then it had what they thought they were wearing, maybe green combat jacket, this, that, and the other, what weapons, and this was for the six terrorists. So that was the six terrorists we knew about. It could have been more, but we knew there were six. So you treat them all the same, but inside, the ones that were identified and had, were armed were disposed, taken out.
The way you say it, we disposed of them.
It's Jamie Bell in me.
I mean, I take it in that environment. You don't want to arrest them. You just want to kill them because they're carrying guns and hand grenades. You don't want to risk that someone's going to fucking throw one at you, do you?
Yeah, but the thing is, we're a bit more professional than that.
Right.
We knew what we were doing. We knew who we were up against. We knew what they had. The trouble is, we were better trained than them.
Yeah,
and that's the, and we knew what we were doing, and that was, we got rid of five of them. Were taken out. Five terrorists were taken out inside the building. One got out, and all 19 hostages came out. So the mission that we had was achieved.
Amazing.
And that's why it's remembered so much. You know, nowadays, it's remembered for that.
When you said earlier about when you do these things, things go wrong. Did anything go wrong on that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, one of the lad's boots went through the window prior to the go, which means it was like almost a semi-compromise because the terrorist heard it. He was on the first floor. This happened on the second floor. He heard the window smash.
Right.
It was a boot went through. Downstairs.
I take it he got told off, did he?
What they did is it just brought the go forward slightly,
right?
Because you've got to make that split decision, which the boss did, and we were in position. But already, when we were on the ground floor, and I looked up after the big explosion, the initiation for the assault to go in, there was already flames coming out of the second floor where we knew that most of the hostages and terrorists were going to be. Suffice to say that one guy got really badly burnt on the leg, hung up on his rope, an abseil rope.
Oh, that was one of the SAS guys?
Yeah, that was on the second floor. I was in command of the bottom floor, so we were going to put the charge against the window and blow it all in. But when I saw the balcony above, it was like very quickly they pulled the detonator out, threw them to one side. That's safe, and that's safe for now. Yeah, it might go off, but it's only a detonator. And then, as we did that, we had to use sledgehammers to enter the library window instead. So that's what I'm saying about adaptability and flexibility.
Yeah.
You don't have to go, you know. You've got to be there to make decisions, and that's what we did. But not only that, you know, one of the lads who had the terrorist there, his gun jammed.
Right.
He couldn't fire it at that time. So there was a number of things actually happened that we found out. Nobody knew they were happening, but afterwards it was quite apparent when you have a little bit of a wash-up or debrief that things had gone wrong. But the mission was always to rescue the hostages. So if it goes wrong, you deal with it, you know, and it might be simple as simple. We see the guy on the back balcony on the second floor. Couldn't get in. His mask was burnt. He threw the mask on the floor. But what did he do? He didn't whinge and whine. He jumped on the balcony, jumped from one balcony across to another balcony to get in the window to keep that momentum going.
And when they blew the window in and there was all the flames, did anybody come over the radio and say, only ask you to blow the bloody window off?
No, because the radios were crap.
Oh, right, OK.
Yeah, they were rubbish.
You have a bit of banter, though, don't you? But I mean, with the guys. But I take it this is so serious now.
No.
Nobody'd be saying that over the radio. No, I might say later on when you go back to the base.
No, but John Mack, actually, when he went to the window, there were the very window they were blowing, Sim Harris was behind it, the BBC sound recorders. He was behind that window, and he was telling him to get out of the way because they were going to put the charge on.
What, and he started waving?
Yeah.
Fucking get out of the way. Fucking wave me, you idiot, I'm blowing up.
No, he was telling him to get out of the way, but he's got his respirator on, see, and he's a jock. Yeah. Yeah, it's all that type of stuff. But it means something.
Yeah.
And he did get out of the way. Because
there was
still
subtitles then.
They still blew it. And they got inside when they went, and he was down on the floor covered in dust and rubbish. So then they threw him out on the balcony, wait there till we finish, and then went back in and did the job.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was some funny parts to it, yeah. But it's serious. And let's be honest, to clear that building, 56 rooms on six levels, it only took 11 minutes.
Wow.
And that's out the back to pronounce everybody accounted for. So it took 16 minutes to get into position, covertly, before the go, and then 11 minutes to clear the building.
And that's always what they say, go. That's the... that's it.
There's different code words you can use, but because the radios were so crap...
They don't have one... They don't have one called shoot the cunt, do they? it's always go. It's all polite, like go. Roger. It's never like shoot the cunt.
I've not heard that one. I shoot the twat, yeah. But no, not that one.
But no, I mean, it is a fascinating world. And obviously, you've had a fascinating life. And to actually have written two books about your life, and obviously have one of them turn into a TV.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm to be honest, I'm surprised.
They're both non-fiction. Pardon? They're both non-fiction.
Right. But that's important as well, because I think the first SA story I read was Andy McNab when he wrote Barber 2-0. That was the first.
Who's he?
I don't know, just some author. I think he was ex-SA guy. But I read his book, and that's then when I thought, oh, this is really interesting. And then I read Chris Ryan's book.
Yeah.
And obviously, I've not had the pleasure of reading your books, Rudy, but...
You are, because I'm going to shove them down your throat after.
Rudy. I'm not going to be Rudy. I'm really looking forward to reading these books, though, because I did love that show. I'm surprised I didn't make one sooner, to be honest.
What, sorry?
I'm surprised I didn't make that into a film sooner, because it happened so long ago, didn't it? 1980.
And me. They made it into a film. It came out in 2017. The training was done, and the rest was done in 2015. So it took a long time.
And what happened with that? Did they approach you about buying your book?
They read the book, Go. And these are New Zealand. They read it, the New Zealand Film Corporation. So they read the book, and then they approached us, having read it, through a person I know in London. And I said, yeah, I'll meet them. You know, and I went to meet them, the producer, Andrew.
Right.
He came across from New Zealand. The scriptwriter, he came across, the director, and I met them all, and they talked through it, and they went back, and they sent me a script to read. I haven't spoken to the guys in Hereford.
Wow.
I took Glenn with me to Hereford for 5 days. He met some of the guys, had a few beers, a couple of fights. but seriously, that's what I did. And then they went back, and he wrote a script. And wow. What do you think? What do I know about scripts? I read it. There was nothing, you know, out of context. Everything was okay. And that's what they did. They got the stuntmen, the actors together, filmed a lot of it in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then they came back to London, to Princess Gate itself, where they finalised the filming and stuff on the real building and everything.
Amazing. I mean, that's, I suppose for you, Rusty, being on set and watching that, it must have been a bit weird, like bringing back the memories. I mean, it's sort of... I mean, do you find from being in the SAS and from doing, you know, your job, some people have obviously had issues with PTSD. Some people do have flashbacks. Some people do have, you know, nightmares. I mean, did you ever suffer anything like that? Or
yeah, you know, I think most people I know... some time, you know, I've been through that. Some worse than others, obviously. By speaking about it, it sort of helped me a bit.
Yeah.
Rather than keeping it, you know.
You find the books did that? You were able to just get something.
Well,
out.
Actually, it's difficult to say that. I do a lot of speaking engagements and type of things, you know, where they want the stories. I've just come back from the States. I was out there for 6 days, 7 days. And the SWAT team invited me across there to speak to them as a guest speaker.
Wow.
So
how does the SWAT team, because I know over there,
they love it.
I mean, they are.
They love it.
They're quite heavy handed, the police over there, aren't they?
Yeah, they are proper police. They don't dance in the street with people. Like
they don't
do
TikTok
here.
Videos.
Sorry?
They don't do TikTok videos.
What's right?
They don't do TikTok videos.
Oh, no, they don't do TikTok. Yeah, so yeah, that's right. But no, they're proper, you know, they really looked after me, us.
Yeah.
And yeah, they wanted the story. I did a podcast for them when I was there.
Amazing.
So, and they were absolutely, nothing was a problem.
Right.
So they recognise it, and their younger members are very keen with questions to find out, because they relate back to this, the siege.
Yeah.
They relate back to that as being the benchmark where it all started, and they still use what they were taught, but we've got far better kit and equipment these days and weapons, but they still say that they go back to how we did it here and what we did as the benchmark, and they took it from that level to that level. And, you know, when I did the one over in Texas, they were exactly the same. The one in San Diego, exactly the same. All of them are very, very interested.
That must make you proud, Rusty, to think, you know, you was part of that, and these people were basically, you know, being a team leader on the thing and having the famous hands, you know, and then them literally going, wow, you know, we follow this now.
They do.
I mean, I suppose it's, if you've got criminals, terrorists, whoever, and really terrorists are criminals, right? So you've got these people doing this stuff, and, you know, I mean, when you was, obviously fast forwarding now from that embassy siege to obviously the Falklands War, when you come back from there, did the SAS ever get involved in any other stuff other than, you know, because I know a lot of you have like the police and then you have the armed police, but
it's different now. In those days they didn't, I know you fast forward, but in those days they didn't have that capability. They had the Met police, but they didn't have the trained firearms like they've got nowadays.
Right, okay.
So hence, that was our speciality, counter-terrorism. So we were there trained already when this embassy came up back in 1980. But nowadays, they've got the firearms departments.
I take it if something happened in the 80s that wasn't terrorism, say it was crime, where there was a shootout or there was a gangland, you know, people with guns and stuff, would the SAS be deployed, obviously, to do that? Because obviously they wouldn't be able to, the Met didn't have the
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know.
What?
But I don't think so for the simple reason there isn't that many SAS guys. You know, there's not reams, and it's not like a battalion, you know, 600 men. Or it's not like that at all. It's much smaller. And, you know, their resources, bearing in mind of what's going on worldwide, has to be taken care of as well. So I doubt it. They've got the firearms department. Use them.
But back then, if there was an issue, an incident with guns or firearms, or that would be something. Well, that it would be count. I suppose back then it wouldn't be classed as crime. It'd be classed as terrorism, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but you spoke about Yvonne Fletcher that got shot.
Yeah.
That was the Libyan embassy. We were.
What is it with these embassies? Is the Libyan embassy?
Well, they get in there. They get in there and they think they've got immunity.
So with talking about the Libyan embassy siege.
Yeah.
What happened with that? So I remember
we were deployed.
The lady who got shot. Was it Yvonne? Fletcher?
Yvonne Fletcher.
Yeah.
She got shot. PC. And the guy never come out, did he? But they couldn't go in. So, I think they might have been deported, but they never ever released who actually shot her.
Wow.
So she was killed outside. And then it went into the diplomatic. As you know, it goes on for as long as it goes on. But nobody actually entered that building.
Wow.
And that was a Libyan embassy shooting.
Yeah.
And it was PC Ivan Fletcher, yeah.
After that, what did you work on any other missions that were of note? I mean, I know every day there can be a mission, but anything that was sort of newsworthy that was, you know, sort of talked about?
No. You know, there's stuff going on all over the world. When I was serving, and there were certain events that happened over the world, and some people were involved, only small amounts. It's not a big news spread, but traditionally helping others, counter-terrorist teams and stuff, that's what we used to do, train other teams. After the embassy siege, everybody wanted to be trained by the SAS. All of a sudden, you could see the pounds, shillings and pence, because it was expensive to get a training team from the SAS. So the British government, right, you know, let's make some money now. And that's what they did. So guys were all over the place training other nationals.
Having worked with other special forces teams in different countries, would you say the SAS is still the number one?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. But not, I would say, wouldn't I?
Yeah.
But actually, from just coming back from America, they'll tell you the same.
Right.
You know, I was down at the Navy SEAL base. I was invited there as a guest only a couple of weeks ago. And speaking to the guys there, and they've got nothing but respect for the SAS. Mm-hmm. So they even... And they, you know, I've got respect for the Navy SEALs. Don't get me wrong. And other counter-terrorism teams.
Yeah.
But, again, to be invited there is one thing. To speak and have a meeting with the guy, the top guy who actually knows people I know. And I had this story when I told him about Delta.
Right.
I might as well come on to this one. Oh, yeah. 1977, I did my selection, as I said.
Yeah.
Bucky Burroughs, he's a guy that was on my selection. Yeah, he's American. He came as part... Not a pass-fail for him. He came on my selection, then went back to Delta. Sorry, went back to the States. And he, along with Charlie Beckwith, set up and formed Delta in 1977.
Wow.
So I was talking to him about that, and he knows a pair of them. And this is the top guy in the SEALs.
So Delta Force come out of...
They were only formed in 1977.
Wow.
By the guy who came on my selection... It's just, I don't believe in coincidences, but he did. And then he went back that year, and I think the Delta Force, I think, were formed November 77.
Wow.
Because he only had to do the first, I think he did the first month with us to see how that all worked, and went back and set up Delta Force.
Well, that's good. The SAS inspired Delta Force. That's a
good one.
I've never heard of that.
That's true.
That's great. I love that.
That's true. It was on my selection.
And what would you say... In your time in the SAS, well, you must have some funny stories.
The trouble is that there's lots of different stories, you know, and some of the guys that the stories are with are no longer with us anymore.
Right.
It doesn't really make them funny.
Right.
But there's all sorts of stories, you know, when you do the courses that you do externally,
right.
You blow things up. And it might be... in a hospital, stood there with a stethoscope with your best mate, like this. You've got love and hate as a doctor on his fucking hands. But the doctors are like, you know, with a big moustache, you know. Right. But there's loads of funny stories. Because, and I'll say one thing, if you haven't got a sense of humour there, don't even bother going, because you're going to need it.
I mean, I did notice that the banter and the camaraderie and the...
Yeah,
you know the you know I think people worry about you know WhatsApp messages, but I've read some of their messages.
Yeah, I mean I'll be honest with you, it's squatty humour at its best, yeah. You know, because some funny characters, and in my opinion, that's a lot of the guys that pass selection, half comedians. You know, because they know when the time gets rough, they know how to push that off.
So what's your sort of plans for the future, Rusty? Because you've obviously got these two books. Obviously, you're doing your public speaking. You've obviously had this amazing life, you know, in the army, and then coming out of the army, and then getting your book turned into a movie. Have you got anything that you want to achieve now, or you? I'll take it you're retired now.
I'd like to move out of England.
Right. Okay. You're not going to Rwanda, are you? Buy a nice little pied de terre.
Rwanda's one country I haven't been to.
Right.
But no, I just feel for everybody that's in the UK.
Right.
Certainly my side. but, you know, there's a lot of stuff I want to do, and we've got plans for. Which are there. But actually, to and from the States is... But actually, I'd move there tomorrow. You know, and I could have done it years ago, but didn't. So there is stuff, you know, by the time Christmas is over, I'll have a better plan. Right. So I've got some stuff in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I enjoy doing what I do.
Yeah.
And I've got some help and support doing that. In fact, they lead it half the time.
Yeah.
Don't you?
But you think I'm not going to stop.
Yeah, you think you're going to head over to the US, though? That's where you think you're going to end up?
I'd like to.
Yeah.
You know, even if it was for a few months of the year.
Are you going to move to Vegas or Miami?
No.
New York?
Probably. Maybe Florida. Donald lives down there.
Florida's nice.
Yeah, I'll go and help him lift his wallet.
Get your little red hat on.
Yeah, I might nip down and have a word with Boris. Not Boris, fucking...
He looks like Boris.
Yeah.
They've got the same hair.
I'm sure Boris doesn't like that idea, that comb over he's got. But yeah, there's a few things I've got. There's no point in stopping still.
No.
There's no point in looking back.
So summing up, you know, anybody watching this, that what would you say?
Still awake.
No, they will be still awake. But what would you say? What would be your pearl of wisdom that you would like to give to the listeners and the viewers on The Criminal Connection?
Well, thanks for putting me on the spot. But actually, it'd be really nice if the listeners who are really serious... I've had a lot of people contact me, by the way, after these podcasts. About different things, and would you stand in this party, would you? And the fact is, you need more than one person now. It's beyond at the moment. But I'd like everybody to express their opinion when they get a chance, because these guys in government, the Prime Minister, they're very thick-skinned, to say the least, and it's going to take a huge effort. But as a front... together, you might have a chance. But if everybody goes their own way and doesn't do anything, we've got no chance. So wake up and wise up and go for it.
Yeah.
We are in disrepair. And all we're doing is going further into disrepair.
Let's make Britain great again, Rusty.
Yeah. But I agree with that. You know, I'm embarrassed from what I remember. Even though I had a bit of a bad bringing up all those years ago, seen it at its best, and now I'm seeing it in decline. I'm not happy.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, Rusty, and it was great hearing your story today.
And I'd come again even if I liked you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. We had a laugh, didn't we? We had a good laugh.
But yeah, part two. Okay. Yeah.
Now, Rusty, thank you so much.
No
problem.
Thank
you so much for the books as well. I'm really looking forward to reading them. I've seen.
I'm going to sign them for you.
But I'm going to.
I'll sign them for you. Yeah.
Thanks for tuning into the Criminal Connection podcast, Rusty Furman. What a fucking legend! What a great guest. Thank you for tuning in. Make sure you like, subscribe, and tell all your friends about the Criminal Connection podcast. And we'll see you next week. See you on the other side.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.